HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to the Investor Hour podcast. I'm your host, Rahul Goyal. The goal of this podcast is to learn from the best investment minds of our times. We want to learn their backstory, essentially, what makes them, them. We want to learn how they make their decisions in their personal lives. And of course, we want to learn about their core principles of investing. Essentially, a lot of learning that could help you make better decisions in life and investing.
Devina Mehra's claim to fame is recommending HDFC Bank at an adjusted stock price of less than rupee 1. But that's nowhere even close to the successes she has racked up over her career. She founded First Global, which is today one of India's most successful global research firms. Along the way, she's had a string of successful calls, including recommending Amazon in 2001. Her biggest contribution yet may be the thoroughness with which she researches a stock, which has evolved into a human plus machine process. Listen in to a fantastic conversation where we discuss all this and our usual favorite topics of portfolio construction, portfolio sizing, and asset allocation. It is a must listen.
So, Devina, welcome to the Equity Master Investor Hour. Delighted to have you on as a guest. I want to first start with a disclosure. I started my career in the mid-90s in the same quantum group, which is now Equity Master. Part of it is Equity Master. And those days, it was very difficult to come across good research reports, right? Those days, you would have the Jardine Fleming research reports, CSFB and all, if you remember. But, and I'm not kidding, the most sought after research report for analysts like me used to be the black and white Xerox copies of the First Global research reports. I actually remember reading those late 90s for sure. I remember reading those. So, you know, I just wanted to put that out. So you guys have definitely, you know, you've got a great research pedigree. And I've been an admirer, a secret admirer of your research reports all this while.
Yeah. Right.
So congrats on that.
Good to hear that.
Wonderful. So we are meeting for the first time. So tell me a little bit about yourself. And when I say a little bit about yourself, I'm really trying to go back to the roots. Where did you grow up? What was the environment in your house? Was your father or mother investing? I just want to get a flavor of what went into the making of Devina.
Okay. So I grew up in Lucknow. And my parents were both in academics, both are professors, and atmosphere at home, and for that matter, in the whole of Lucknow, was as far away from business and investing as you can imagine. Lucknow back then, I don't know what it is like now, but back then was not at all a business city. So it was primarily educational institutes, research institutes, government, that kind of thing. And that is how I grew up. So didn't
food.
Even think.
And think great of,
sorry?
And great food. Lucknow.
Yes, of course. Yeah. I mean, great food, great culture, heritage, yeah. All of that. As I always say that, and I used to say even when growing up, that it had the advantages of a big city, like lots of bookshops, theaters, flower shows, all of that. And yet the atmosphere of a small town in terms of neighborliness and obviously, you know, which you realize only when you come out of that city, that it that the language and the genteel way of life. Mm-hmm. And so I was there till, and then I actually went to Delhi to do English honors, and I came back after one term back to Lucknow because I realized that the Delhi university system meant that you were effectively studying only one subject. So I said that, you know, 5 years, I don't want to study English. So mm-hmm. I came back and I did math, statistics, and English literature. So I was the only person in the university with this combination. So that was and then when I went to IIM, till I went to IIM, actually, I had no idea what a share was, what a debenture was, let alone finance. I had no background in economics either, even though my mother is a postgraduate in economics, but, you know, it never, but, you know, she was teaching education at that time. So, you know, so I really had no idea about anything of this sort. So everything they taught during the MBA at IIM Ahmedabad was completely new for me, and which was the fun part for me, because, you know, right from the time that I was very young to now, the biggest thrill in my life is learning. So, you know, that way this profession is ideal, because there are very few professions in the world where 30 plus years later, you can still say you are learning every day, and there is not going to be a day when you know it all, because you can't know it all.
That's right.
So that was the education part of it.
Yeah. And your parents, that, your parents were not investors. They didn't invest.
No. As far away from finance, I don't think they even knew their salaries. They had no interest in money matters whatsoever.
Very interesting.
So my father was a maths professor, and my mother was teaching education, the B.Ed. basically, the teacher training kind of thing.
So there is some maths and economics somewhere in the house.
Maths, yes. Very much. Maths was a, I mean, that was the reason I came back from Delhi. I said, why give up maths just now? So that, of course. But,
that's okay. So there is something.
Know, finance and investing, one I never thought of. You know, it was not there in the whole scheme of things, and nobody else was discussing it either. So that was how it was growing up there.
Yeah. And then you chose to sit for the CAT exam, I'm assuming.
And Lucknow wasn't even a center for CAT. You had to go to Kanpur to give the exams.
Oh, that must have been, that's the 80s, right? Did I get that right?
Sorry, 80s, yes. 80s.
So you must have been, how was it those days? You must have been one of the very few women in the center applying and doing the exam and all, or had things started to change?
Yeah, that was not a very mainstream thing. I mean, in those days, when you're growing up, it was engineering, medicine, the civil services in UP. That is big.
That's the big.
And of course, you know, then otherwise academics, or maybe going bank PO kind of. Those were the career options. But I mean, while I loved maths, and I, you know, till 11th, 12th, I never lost a mark in maths in any of my tests or exams. But I was the only person in my maths class who did not sit for the engineering entrance, because I was equally clear that I didn't want to become an engineer. So I've been clearer about what I didn't want to do rather than what I did want to do. So it like a lot of things came by process of elimination, including, you know, what kind of career to choose after an MBA. So kind of process of, sorry.
How were your 2 years at IIM Ahmedabad?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it because, you know, so many new things to learn. So that was the big interesting thing for me. Of course, it was tough also in terms of, you know, the amount of things you have to compress into that time. And for me personally, the big change also was that till then I was very used, because you had plenty of time. And even though I didn't study through the year, just by studying last 2-3 months, you could know your subject inside out. In IIM, you didn't have that luxury. So, because the time was so short. So that took a, you know, mental switch, that to give exams without being as thoroughly prepared as I was used to being. But otherwise it was fun. And of course, you know, the friendships and all of that as well. And I was the youngest in my class. I was 19 when I joined. So.
And that's where you got exposed to the stock market, shares, etc.?
Yes. I mean, you came to know at least in theory. But see, when I graduated, there was nothing like an equity research job. That securities industry did not exist. And even in IIM, let alone a course, we did not even have a full module on security analysis or anything of that sort. It didn't exist. I, by a process of elimination, applied to banks and consultancy firms. And actually, I just interviewed at Citi and, you know, got in. And so that was probably the only interview I gave in the first place. So in Citibank, I was in investment banking, what used to be called merchant banking back then. Again, it was very different. I don't know whether your viewers would ever know this, that this was, of course, pre-SEBI. and there was no free pricing of issues. There used to be a department in the Ministry of Finance called Controller of Capital Issues, CCI, which used to set the price and all that. So what you could do was fairly limited. I did do some innovation, like one of them was buying back the non-convertible part of partly convertible debentures and packaging it and selling it to UTIs and LICs and all that. But there was a limit to what you could do. And actually, after a couple of years, I said, I've learned all that I want to learn and I want to move out of this. But it somehow stretched out. And of course, as they say, in hindsight, sometimes the dots connect. So this is one of those times. So I was in investment banking for roughly about 5 years. In the last 2 years in Citi, I was in credit analysis, which again, was very helpful later on. So, both these things actually contributed to my career going forward after that. And the trigger for me to move out of Citi and into this business actually were two. One was that in 1992, the Bombay Stock Exchange, the NSE did not exist then. So the Bombay Stock Exchange advertised that they would be giving 71, I still remember that number, 71 new memberships to professionals at 55 lakhs each. At that time, the market price of the card was 2 crores. So, this was at a quarter of the price. And people told us that BSE is a broker's club and you are not a Guju, you're not a Marwadi, you're never going to get it, let alone know anybody in the stock exchange. I said, let me try. So I often say that, all this, they say visualize your goal. Like I used to use the Silva method, which is, I think, pretty similar to what The Secret talks about. And to me, this was like getting the BSE card was the biggest endorsement that this system works, because there were so many reasons why I wouldn't have got it, but I finally did get it. And for that, again, this, the merchant banking experience came in handy because they required capital market experience. And while I didn't have broking experience, this counted. If I had been elsewhere in the bank, it would not have counted. So that counted. And of course, all the things of nobody really wanted to give me to have that card. But finally, I got 2 extra marks for my IIM gold medal. And that pushed me over the cutoff. I didn't even know that such a thing, such a provision existed. But and so that was that. And the as it happened, 1993 budget, Dr. Manmohan Singh opened the market to foreign institutional investors. So for me personally, I said, like, now is the time this market will professionalize. Now is the time professional stock research will come in. So I actually resigned even before I had got the BSE membership. So BSE membership came towards the end of 93. I resigned a few months before that. And so that started really the journey of equity research for me, and in some senses for India itself, that it did not exist. I would, now you have all these investor relations departments and all that. Those days you would call up companies and they would say that, why should we meet you?
Thank you.
What is this equity research? Read our annual report, come to the AGM if you want to. So I did a lot of this heat and dust thing of going around the countryside to the outskirts of NCR, Hyderabad, Chennai. Sometimes I just, some companies who were very conservative and would not meet, I would just land up at the factory gate and see ki koi to milega, kuch to malum chalega. And I loved doing plant visits. So even in my Citibank days, I used to do plant visits, not just for myself, but sometimes for my colleagues also, because everybody else hated doing it. Who wants to take a train to a Wadi in Andhra Pradesh to see a ACC plant, or go to Jamshedpur to see a Tisco plant, or go to Renukoot and see Hindalco's aluminium plant? But I used to love all of that. Wow. And in many ways, that credit analysis training was also very useful, because as a banker, you don't participate in the upside of a company. So your focus is solely on what can go wrong, what are the risks. Whereas if you come straight into equity, it is always very rara, all the good things are going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was very good grounding that you must look at what can go wrong.
Wow.
So that was, as I said, both these things kind of the dots connected in hindsight.
I was going to say exactly that. That's everything seems to have connected and led to this moment. So along this entire journey,
until you quitting and setting up First Global, did you venture out as an individual investor? Did you put money in the market? Because just a year before 92, the markets were peaking, right? And then, of course, then the Harshal Mehta scam unfolded. So were you involved? Yeah. Were you doing something?
Not a lot. I did do some, and that's how that 55 lakhs was also collected. I think Harshal Mehta Teji helped in that.
Just tell me more about that. I'm keen to understand, what did you do?
Did put some money and got out in time. That's all one can say about some of those stocks. Wow. Prior to that, of course, not. I started little late into the market. So it wasn't as if as soon as I started working, I got into the market. So it was, again, fortunate that there were also a Citibank subsidiary where we got stock as employees. And then later on, that listed Citicorp Securities. So that was actually, again, a tidy sum of money where you had practically put in nothing. And even though I started a little late, as I said, I started working very early at 21. So, you know, even those last 3, 4, 5 years was not really a very long time in terms of age. I was still fairly young. Would
you remember the stocks that you bought in the Harshal Mehta rally?
Right from ACC onwards, several.
When you talk of Harshal Mehta, you have to have ACC, right? The famous, what was it? The replacement cost theory or something. I don't know what was it.
One didn't buy totally into the theories, but for some time you could ride the ride and you also
you bought a share,
money.
You bought a share of the profits. Okay. Before again, I come to First Global. When did you make the first serious investment?
This was First Global also. Let me also tell you that this is when I was talking about the membership and all. Those days, Bombay Stock Exchange did not allow corporate membership. So the funda used to be that a stock broker, the liability must be unlimited. So it could only be a proprietorship or a partnership. So the BSE card was in my personal name. So if you even in my, if you see the early research reports, including that HDFC Bank report with the baby and Arnold Schwarzenegger, at the bottom it says member Messrs. Devina Mehra. And of course, the Guju brokers could not get my name right ever. So all kinds of, I used to get post addressed to, of course, Mehra. Mehta to hi jata tha. Uske baad Devina also they could not get. I used to sometimes get things like Divana Mehta and things like that. totally absurd. So of course, I mean, once you made the switch into the markets, then you started also buying stock because that was what you were researching.
We'll talk about that a little bit more later. Okay, right. So First Global, you explained that market was going to professionalize. It was the right time to be there. But I'm assuming when you got the card and entered, on the one hand were the traditional brokers, shops. On the other hand were these slick foreign research houses. What did you have in mind? What ultimately the manifestation of what you believed in is probably that first report, not the first report, the report that you guys put out on HDFC Bank, which is, I guess, the stuff of legends, right?
Yeah, that was in 1996.
So tell me a little bit more on what you have in mind and how did it result in that?
Right. So as I said, even in terms of academics, one didn't know really equity research or securities research. So it was very much learning on the job. I mean, obviously, you learned how to analyze companies in a sense in credit, which was a good grounding, but still equity is a somewhat different kettle of fish. So you're right that, one lot, of course, had no pretensions of doing research, which was the old style brokers. So that was, and we had, when I formed this company, I had that our primary target was the foreign institutional investors. So in fact, we were a purely institutional and 90% foreign institutional house for much of the 90s. So that was very much so. It was only that that I remember this, that taking out the list of all the registered FIIs from SEBI and or earlier, I think, I don't know, maybe Ministry of Finance or RBI had it. I don't know where that site was. And then sending letters to all of them. And, you know, few of them responded. And that's how you got going. And you're right that there was this other lot, which was the foreign brokers. So along with the FIIs, the foreign brokers came. And in the beginning, I thought, you know, all these guys have been doing this for 50 years, 100 years. So let me learn how they do it. And I saw some of the reports and, I mean, doesn't sound very good, but I thought they were junk. You know, I thought not great analysis, not great style. I said, isse kuch nahi seekhne ko milega. I'll have to go to first principles. And that's what I did. So that is how I started researching. At times, I remember even asking some clients that, you know, which book do you recommend for cash flows, for example. I remember asking a client this and he said, Tom Copeland, padho. And so on DCF analysis. So that's how, so I did it that way. So it was even in terms of how our research was written, you know, I mentioned this baby and Arnold Schwarzenegger, or if you remember us earlier reports also, we used to see that the fund managers would throw away a lot of the research unopened. So we always used to tell our analysts, I used to say that, please, first of all, you have to get read. So the cover page has to be attractive enough for somebody to open it. It has to be, now you have that term clickbait, that didn't exist then, but that's essentially what I was telling them, that you must, you know, it is like Stardust mein upar likha hota hai na, ki, you know, who is Kareena Kapoor having an affair with? So we want something like that.
Yeah,
so so it was very good substance, but it was also interesting enough for people to pick up. So because, you know, there's just like a bullet points, graphs, you yourself don't want to read that. You start to fall asleep. So and we realize that fund managers ultimately are also people. So they would tell, for example, you know, a lot of fund managers would go to meet, they'd say, you know, what's the story of this company? So we actually, you know, in a kind of ironical thing, we started to, after the title page, we used to have something called the story, which is what you would have conversationally told a fund manager. Oh. And we also thought of, you know, many, again, it's only first principles thinking, which has, you know, been my bedrock all through my life, that I remember first time an FII was visiting and they asked me to set up a number of meetings with the companies, which was a regular thing. And along with everything else, I had on top a list of questions that she could ask. And she said that I work in so many countries and no broker has ever done that. And to me, it was logical that, you know, she's meeting HDFC Bank, Gujarat Ambuja Cement, Mahindra and Mahindra. What will she remember? And she looks after maybe, you know, 8 or 10 countries, that what to ask where you do that. So it is just like plain. And also, I had a lot of interest in going deeply into the theoretical aspects of things also. So came up with new ratios, for example, on instead of, you know, that growth adjusted PE being PE by growth, which is really a meaningless number. It actually had a weighted average number, looked at not just long-term DCF, which you can, you know, just tweak the terminal value assumptions a bit and you can come up with any number you want. So looking at shorter term cash flows, how to capture that, did for individual industries also, like this, I remember in the those days, of course, Tata Motors or Telco, as it used to be called, was a commercial vehicle maker in India. That was, it didn't have cars, it didn't have the global business, and CVs was a very cyclical business. So I remember in the late 90s, there was a year which was very bad, I think 98 or something. And the next year, we were looking at what would happen. And we did a regression analysis. And we said this year, volumes will grow 25% for Tata Motors and for Ashok Leyland. And we put out that report and we actually got a call from Ratan Tata's office saying that this is a ridiculously high number. We don't think we'll do more than 15. So you please, you know, reduce the estimates. And I looked at everything, I checked out everything and said, we are standing by our assumptions and our estimates. And ultimately they did do 25%.
Wow. Maybe sometime I'll call you back.
So that is the thing. That's the fun part of it. When analysts come, and I have trained generations of analysts because I never hired people with experience because there's too much unlearning to be done. So I always hired freshers. So in a sense, I have alumni all over and people who contact on Guru Purnima and Teachers Day and all of that.
That's what I mean.
And so you have these young people joining, and in the beginning, everybody is jittery, saying that I am so young, so and so. You know, the CEO, and unlike in banking, you are dealing with the CEO and CFO. That these people have been doing it for 30 years, 40 years. How can I question what they are doing?
Yeah.
And the fact is that as managers, often the view becomes very myopic. You extrapolate the immediate past. When you're looking at a cross-section of industries, when you're looking at how things panned out around the globe, you have a different perspective. I remember telecom, in the boom days of Bharti and all that, we did a whole detailed piece on how that over a time cycle in different countries, how you see the growth tapering of the piece compressing. And it was very clear where it was on the curve. At that time, of course, fund managers didn't want to listen to that story. But once you do the number, things are clear. So also, the this century's first decade, that infrastructure boom, again, you look at the numbers, you look at what's happening to return ratios, cash flows. And it was very clear that the bust was coming.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just to sort of split that a little bit.
Right.
You mentioned first principles a couple of times.
Right.
Talk to us what first principles means to you. We know how it's helped you in getting things right. But just talk to us a little bit more how you would split that and how people should think about the way they go in making decisions and picking stocks.
Okay, so this is, when I talk first principle, I'm not necessarily even talking of just stocks. I'm saying that from first principle, you can learn pretty much anything in life. So I've done it in medicine, I've done it in law, I've done it in many things. And so first of all, don't think that somebody else has all the answers. But if you want to do this, then you have to go in depth. So go into the depth of industry, company, financials. And oftentimes, as I say, people do a very surface level understanding of financials, look at margins, look at what the growth has been, and that's about it. I mean, no one goes in depth into the balance sheet, into the cash flows. So I was looking at this data. Of course, this is about maybe 10 years ago or something, that even a large company like GE, the annual report was downloaded only some 200 times. So most people don't do the math, it is too hard.
They take it from the investor presentation, the highlights.
So if you have to, anything you do, I mean, for example, macroeconomics, and we went global towards the end of the 90s, which I haven't spoken about yet. But I mean, just to come to the first principles thing, I remember the first few macroeconomic reports that we did for the US and UK, I did not have a person with an economics degree on board. So I had those regular engineer MBA type. And they said, madam, ye kaise hoga? I said, you do it the same way we do company financials, that if you're estimating GDP, one key thing which I always do, whether it is company or any other kind of estimates, that go granular, go to the level of detail to which anything is available. So if your GDP, if you break it up to the extent available and you estimate everything, you think about every row and you estimate it, your final number is going to be more accurate than anyone else's. So I remember the very, and this is like a bold thing to do, the very first report we did on the UK macroeconomy said the Bank of England GDP estimates are not going to be met. That was the cover. That was the title. And they were not met. And so that was, as I said, without an economist on board, but simply because we were doing that. If you're looking at a company, for example, I never did this, that EBITDA is 14. So next period, it's going to be either 12 or 16. Then you are going at a tangent. So I actually estimate, sales to the extent you can, volume, price, for each product to the extent available. When you're looking at cost parameters, not everything varies with sales. It's a very simple insight, but most people just do a percentage of sales estimate. But you know, raw material volumes will go with sales volume, but price you'll have to estimate separately. If you look at labor, for example, or you know, employee cost or you know, wages and salaries, that grows at a certain rate more or less regardless of what's happening to sales. Sales shrinks 10% or grows 20%, that line will grow. And also, you know, sales might be something else which might vary with assets. So that kind of granular detail you have to go into if you are going to make a sensible estimate. Again, people look at only margins of companies without looking at the balance sheet size. So as a, you know, if you, in it, I have done a couple of videos on DuPont analysis, that often there's a trade-off between asset turnover and margin. That how much are you making in-house, for example, you know, Tesla may be making more components in-house than another company which might be outsourcing. So Tesla will have a lower asset turnover but higher margin. So those kind of trade-offs, again, people don't understand. People do mota-mota ki is company ka itna margin hai, competitor ka itna hai. So there is this gap which can be bridged, which may or may not be bridged. Of course, see, now a lot of things we do, again, you know, so doing what we did in the 90s was step one. What we are doing now is very different. So that now we have moved on to artificial intelligence, machine learning, really codifying a lot of the expertise into a system.
Yeah. So before we come to that system, which we need to talk about, and there's so much we need to unpack, but here's a fundamental question, right? When you started doing all this, first principles, you're writing reports on economics without having a economist on your team, you're going to the ground, you're doing granular research and letting the number emerge, right? You're saying, okay, 5% here or there. You're not spreading the Excel sheet to the right, but you're going ground up and letting the number emerge, and whatever emerges is a good estimate. Right. Where did the drive to do that come? Because that is so contrarian, right? I'm assuming there were very few people who would have even thought to do that. So what was the driving force behind that?
Driving force, really, I mean, first of all, fundamentally, is the learning part of it. I always used to, when hiring, also tell people that if I had graduated now, I would do this for free. You know, so the money is, of course, input and output in this business is money, but I am really there for the learning. So I always liked hiring when, and this is a cyclical business, when this was not the in industry, because then you get people who are genuinely interested. Otherwise, in the boom years, everybody applies. So really the drive was that I must understand this more and more. I mean, for example, even when I was in Citi and I was a credit analyst, at that time, of course, the focus was really to understand industries and companies. I used to, you know, my benchmark used to be that if I'm looking after steel or cement or whatever, nobody should be able to ask me a question I can't answer. And you, as a professional, again, I took pride in the fact that when I would meet companies also, I would normally not take notes in a meeting. That I must know the whole picture well enough that in a conversation, I can, the other person would not even know why I'm asking a particular question and where it's fitting in my mental map. Which worked very well as a banker, didn't work so well here, because there what you write is never seen by the client. But of course, in equity, people see it, and then at times they would get upset that you had, you know, you're saying that our plans don't make sense or whatever.
But I like your approach, because, and I think it's true of so many things in life, if you center your focus in learning and if you have a love of learning, it just solves not just investing, or so much more in life in terms of the decision-making process. That's, that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing the thought. I think the listeners and the viewers, I'm sure there's...
It is truly the biggest thrill for me, and not just things relating to finance and investing. I like to feed my mind with all kinds of stuff. So
You mentioned medicine a while back, right?
That was, I'm saying that whatever comes on your plate for a particular thing, you can research and understand. No. That is the thing. That I'm fairly confident about. So, and, you know, very few. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that you can become a NASA scientist in, you know, 5 months. But I'm saying most things in life are not that complex that you can't understand it if you put your mind.
If you asked Elon Musk, he would say, yes, you can become in 5 months. Okay. I want, before we move forward from the late 90s, I want to go back to 96. Tell us more about that big report on HDFC Bank, the 38 rupee price.
Yeah, which is 3.8 split adjusted.
Sorry, what is it split adjusted?
3.8.
That makes it what, a 400 bagger? Yeah? A 400 bagger. So tell us a little bit, how did the stock come into your screen? What was the process? Did you go and meet Mr. Puri? And did you tell him?
Okay, so I mean, that was a relatively easy one in the sense that, see, I mean, generally, I'm not a big fan of banking as a business in the sense that has a potential for more negative surprises than positive surprises. And you don't know where the negative surprises are going to come from. So in general, I am a little cautious as far as lending businesses are concerned. And if you lived long enough, every decade, there is a lending boom and bust, whether it's in leasing companies, whether it's, you know, called something else, but it comes and it goes. So, I mean, of course, the broad thing, of course, was there of the India economic post-economic reforms, that, and also that the PSU banks were dominant and there was therefore some market share which would probably go to these large companies. But I mean, I say that in HDFC Bank's case, I had an unfair advantage in that HDFC Bank was primarily staffed by ex-City bankers, including Aditya himself. And I knew those people and I could bet on their management skills. I knew what kind of risk managers they had. And therefore, I could trust that, you know, nothing too drastically wrong in terms of lending would happen. So, unlike Amazon, which was also a completely, Amazon was a completely contrarian call. You spoke about contrarian calls. There was not a single buy on Wall Street when we had a strong buy on Amazon at $15, split adjusted at 75 cents in 2001. That was a pure based on finances and numbers call. HDFC Bank, there's an X factor because I knew the people, and in banking, ultimately, you are to a large extent betting on the people.
Okay. So that sort of solves the mystery a bit.
I mean, you had the estimates in the finances, but I'm saying the comfort factor was there because you put in banking, you can't always trust the numbers.
That's right. But again, a big, I don't want to sound condescending, but big pat on the back for the cover. The cover is superb. Someone who sent the cover and I saw it. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, till now, whenever I meet anyone who has ever worked in HDFC Bank, you know, within the first 5 minutes, they will bring this up.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, now let's talk global, right? So late 90s, you go global. And so related to global, you know, in our conversation, you spoke of infrastructure, you spoke of telecom a while back, and you kept mentioning global. If you looked at global trends, if you looked at global patterns, so there was of course something brimming out there. So tell us what led to this whole global thing. How did it help in our domestic research? And then we'll talk about a few stocks like Amazon and try and figure out a little bit more.
Yeah. So let me just first tell you that again, this is an example of pure first principle thinking, because since I was a kid, I could never take this thing off that this you should do this because that's the way it happens. For example, as a kid, I was very clear, I will not change my name after marriage because it was never logical to me why you should change it.
I think all of us who are listening and watching this, we've already got a sense your parents were very patient people, right? They were very calm, quiet, not just probably focused on what they were doing. So you could probably get away with all this. Or did you get into trouble?
Why get away? I mean, this is a sad way to put it. I mean, why get away? I mean, what is wrong with this? I mean,
traditional go. Yeah, you have to. I am putting it in context. In the 80s, yeah. In the Indian household, you know, you had to.
Fortunate. I mean, it is sad that I have to say fortunate that most girls don't get that. I never faced any discrimination between a son and a daughter while growing up. In fact, my father was very keen to have a daughter as his firstborn. And this is like over 60 years ago. And he was, and then my twin brothers were born. But he said, no, you know, without a daughter, the family is not complete. So I, well, growing up in terms of career, in terms of education, there was never any thought that it has to be anything different. So I had that very attractive thing that it was a very loving, you can say almost a pampered kind of upbringing, yet without overprotectiveness. So I was among the first people to start traveling on my own, or, you know, those kind of things. My parents never held back, and let alone where I want to study. My father's only thing, he resisted my going for MBA only for one reason. He said, pehle, you know, apna maths or statistics or post-graduation kar lo, then you go. So according to him, this was like a vocational course. And even after that, his whole thing was not that I should get married or anything. His thing was that, why don't you go to Harvard for a PhD? So it's very different. So, I mean, coming back to the first principles thinking, see, there were two triggers for going global. One was the Asian crisis of 98 or so. Which showed that Asian markets fell in dollar terms between 50 to 90%. So Taiwan fell 50% and Indonesia fell
97, 98. 98, yeah, so, went bust. I think 97, all the Far East.
97 to 98, yes. Yeah. So that was a wake-up call that being in a single country can be very injurious to health. So if you were an investor in Indonesia, you'd be down 90% in dollar terms in 1 year. So that was one. The other thing was I was just simply bored of doing the same old companies. Kab tak ye SBI or, you know, by that time, or HDFC, Mahindra. And by that time, these IT companies had also come, Infosys, Wipro, etc. Kab tak yehi karte rahenge? So, you know, do something more. And let me tell you, it was an absolutely outrageous idea at the time, because we were dealing with FIIs, so not just the India fund managers. By that time, you become friends with their bosses and bosses and all that. So fairly senior people in the fund management industry. So when I had this idea, came to bounce it off them, and they said that if you want to go global, go to another emerging market, or, you know, two emerging markets, whatever, you know, Thailand, Philippines, and maybe the fund manager who's doing India will also give you some business there. I said, what's the point of that? What's the point of adding small markets? So I want to go to the bigger markets. So I said, who's going to listen to you on, which were the big companies then, on an IBM or a Microsoft or Walmart? And if you want to go to the US, then go and do the smaller stocks, which don't have much coverage. I said, no, if I know how to do this, I'll do the bigger stocks. No, dekhte hain. So I was like, this is totally, no one said that this could be done. I mean, after that, of course, yes, outsourcing of research, etc., became more commonplace. But this, at that time, which is now almost 25 years, nobody had thought of it. Nobody thought it could be done. First Global was the first, not just Indian, but first Asian member of the London Stock Exchange. Other than the Japanese, nobody had gone there. And then the NASD. So this is 99-2000, LSE in 99, I think, NASD in 2000. And we covered the largest stocks. And, you know, the eye-opening part was this. See, unlike India, where at least you have some relationship with the media, you know some of the people. There, we didn't know anyone. It was only anonymous, in a sense, just your work getting emailed to, you know, and in no time, it was picked up everywhere, from Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Forbes, Fortune, everywhere. And I remember walking into a party, and I didn't even know this. And you know, this very senior person from the industry came and said, Devina, you can retire today. I said, what happened? Said, like, have you seen Alan Abelson's column in Barron's? I said, no. I said, and he showed me, he said, this says that First Global's research is credible and often more than that. He said, like, with an endorsement like this, what more do you want?
That's so nice.
And again, we were not afraid to say what we felt. So Amazon, of course, was on the positive side. That this was in 2001 when everybody who had been an Amazon bull, including Mary Meeker, Mary Meeker's report had come. The title was throwing in the towel on Amazon. So everybody said this company is going bust. And we looked at the numbers and we said, this is the first time in the history of the company it has made substantial cash flows. In the last quarter of 2000, it had made about, I think, $220 or $240 million of cash flows. We spoke to the company just saying that, you know, are our numbers correct? Are we missing out anything? They said, numbers are correct. I said, we don't want any forward-looking statement, but just wanted confirmation. And we put out a strong buy. And Jeff Bezos sent a mail saying thanks for the support because ours was the only buy.
Wow. Have you framed that?
On a strong buy. Nobody else even had a buy.
Have you framed that email anywhere?
Business Week had a cover, I think, the same week saying, is Amazon going bust? I mean, the consensus was that it's going bust, but we could not understand what people were looking at, you know. And similarly, the two big scandals of that era, Enron and WorldCom, both of which we caught. So WorldCom, we actually did a report saying we are discontinuing coverage on the company because we are unable to reconcile the numbers. The capex and the cash flows don't match. And that's exactly where the scam was. I mean, we didn't know there was a scam, but we said the numbers don't match and we cannot continue coverage when we don't know what's going on. We spoke to the company and we still could not reconcile the numbers. So, but that was the good fun part. And the companies there are much more complex and industries are much more fast changing. You know, when we started in the early 2000s, US tech meant IBM, Dell, Motorola, Cisco. That was tech. Only Microsoft was a tech major then and it's a tech major now. All other companies still exist, but they are no longer, you know, of great relevance. So that it's very interesting because that its level of complexity is at a different level. Whereas in India, if you see, primarily the same companies.
So the global exposure gave you that experience.
And global, we actually went global. It was not just US, also UK, Europe, even Japan and China, you know, Baidu and all we've been covering since then.
Oh, wow. We should talk a little bit more about that. But I want to ask you this. You've of course shared, and I've also brought up some of your reports, which are really, you know, flagship reports. Is there any report that you regret having put out where you say, you know, maybe we could have done a better job?
You're not right, of course, 100% of the time. Yeah. Like, for example, in that tech boom in the late 90s in Indian IT services companies, we thought the valuations were way off, mm-hmm. but they kept going up from there for a long time. So, you know, that was actually a big learning experience. We were right in certain things. Like, for example, those days, I remember these companies had less than 10,000 employees, Infosys, Wipro, etc. The biggest employer in India, of course, was Indian Railways, I think with 1.6 lakh employees. In the private sector, it was Tata Steel with some 65,000 employees. And we did a report saying that, you know, pretty soon these companies will become the largest employers in India. And people thought we were crazy. That Tata Steel se jada employees ho jayenge iske, this is crazy. But he said that this is simple math. If they have to grow, that is where it will be. And it did happen. But as I said, the valuations we thought were crazy and we were wrong on that. So that happens, of course. You're not going to be right 100% of the time.
So one of the things I talk about in the podcast are critical days, right? So one of them is March 2020, when the markets start to sell off.
Right.
Famously, someone called, what did someone say about Buffett? That he does not get it or something like that. And within 2 weeks of his announcement and his annual report coming out, et cetera, market started collapsing. So you've, of course, shared the US part of it, where you bought Amazon post-collapse and all that. But when the tech collapse started to unravel, right, how was that experience for you in terms of the research you had put out, in terms of how you were seeing it happen? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, see, I mean, we were not, see, a lot of it happened on the dot-com side, of course. So where it was not as if that we were recommending a whole lot of stocks. So that was, of course, one what one had not anticipated was that that after that NASDAQ sell-off in that tech collapse for almost 15 years, NASDAQ did not come back to that level, which is something which people forget in history. You know, last year in 2021, when all these NASDAQ ETFs and all were coming and funds were coming and people thought that you can't go wrong buying NASDAQ. Actually, I mean, no one remembered that for 15 years, NASDAQ didn't give return. So the thing is, anything is to look at data. That is what I go by.
And that so probably helped you tide over that because you avoided all the ones which didn't have cash flow, right?
Yeah. So that was that we've been fairly cash flow driven and return on equity, return on capital driven.
Yeah.
And
what about 2008? Lehman. What about the Lehman collapse? Where, how was that? Where were you on the day when this big announcement was made and how did you interpret it on what's going to happen?
That was like, those were, of course, stocks that we used to cover. It was a sharp kind of, sharper, obviously, collapse than one had anticipated because you'd not anticipated a big firm actually going under. But then US moved fast on the bailout at the time. So they made sure that things like AIG, etc. didn't go under.
Well, AIG couldn't go under because they owed Goldman money. there's the conspiracy
theory. So, I mean, the US is good at that. So it was like they are always there to, and nobody went to jail for the scam either. So it was they are always focused on keeping the markets going, keeping the whole system going, rather than just chasing something with no end in sight, for that matter. You know, Harshad Mehta, now it is 30 years and it is still not done. And he did have the money to repay at that time and for a long time afterwards as well.
Any big call you guys made in 2008 that you remember that went right or wrong? I remember the late 2008, early 2009, a lot of people... Please go ahead.
Yeah, 2009, we thought, you know, the turnaround was coming. That I remember making a report on that.
Yeah, but, so that was okay. So you got that bounce back. And what about the pandemic? Where were you
pandemic,
guys?
Pandemic, actually, that is pretty much on record because beginning of March, we actually tweeted saying, that something unprecedented is happening because I remember those were the first time schools were shut in Japan and Italy at that time. And there were these pictures of all the tourist attractions of Italy with nobody there. You know, now those pictures have become commonplace. But at that time, it was like a shock. I said, this has not even happened during the world wars. So
it was because of your global exposure and the setup that you got access to that. Because I think that was just starting to filter into India. It was still not common.
No, it is. I mean, abhi to chi, everything is on social media. So it doesn't matter whether you're in India or elsewhere. Everything is there on social media, on the internet. So I don't think there is any differential in what information you get. So that, and so we did in each, depending on our products, we increased cash in multi-asset products. We, for example, our global multi-asset products, where we normally have 70-80% equity, we went to single-digit equity.
Oh, wow.
That much of a switch we made. We bought insurance through put options where we, in equity-only products. So with the result that when that collapse came, as against most funds which went down, you know, 30, 35, 40%, we went down only 10, 12%. And that too because in US, for example, we had moved to investment grade debt. But actually, even investment grade debt took a hit. Right. Only treasuries remained protected. So it was partly right, but we could have done better had we moved into treasuries rather than investment grade debt.
And did you catch the mouse back? Did you catch the
bounce? In fact, that again is on record because on March 23rd, we tweeted saying time to be back. And March 23rd, we got back into the global markets. India, we got back after another 5-7 days. So So, yeah, but I had written a blog recently on this, that people say that tell us when to get out and tell us when to get back in. But I said, even if I tell you, will you be able to do it? Like if I had told you on the March 2 get out and March 23rd get in, you wouldn't do it. And then if you missed out the move up to April, from that March 23rd to April end was a 30% move in India and in the US, 28 to 30%. If you miss that, you missed it out.
Yep.
And so also I was just looking at, you know, in June this year, I was on some of the TV channels and I also made a video and I wrote a blog and saying that now the danger is in not being invested rather than being invested. So I said, I don't know whether this is the exact bottom, but it is somewhere in the vicinity. As I was checking that day, the Nifty was 15,293, almost the bottom. And so, you know, you had an 18% move in 2 months, which most people missed out, because even though we went out telling everyone you get back in, people kept sitting on the fence, sochte hain.
Well, on a lighter note, Vibina, you're going to get a lot of Twitter followers after this is published.
So actually, see, everything comes out of data. See, all these are not like some flashes of insights I'm getting. So this, what I, the call that I made in June was based on, we looked at, so we all have this thing in our mind that if you invest in Indian equities, you will get roughly 15% plus returns, right?
That is true.
So which has been the, from the time the Sensex started, that's about the compounding. Now, first of all, every decade that has varied widely, that's another matter. No, but we said, suppose you miss out on the 10 best days. So like that 100 rupees you invested in 1979 would have become 44,000. But if you miss out on the 10 best days, 2/3 of that return goes, that 44,000 comes down to 15,000. If you miss out on the 30 best days, which is less than one day a year, your returns come down to 4,000. 90% of your returns go. Same, pretty much the pattern is the same in S&P. In 100 years, if you miss out 100 good days, you have negative returns. Can you imagine?
Wow.
So when we did that analysis, and the other thing which we found was that the good days come after a drop when generally the sentiment is bad.
Very bad, yeah.
Almost always. The only exceptions were 2 days during the Harshad Mehta Teji, because that was a rigged market. Otherwise, in a normal market, they never come in the bull phase. So that is why I made that call in June, that now that markets are down, NASDAQ was 40% down. It was almost the worst performing index in the world. Out of 42 indices, it was 40 or 41. I said, now the risk is that you'll miss the bounce back.
Yeah.
And so also in India.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I have to talk to you about automated systems, but we'll just push that down a bit because you alluded to, you know, you should be invested and you were giving all the data. So one of our other pet discussion topics on the Investor Hour is portfolio construction.
Right.
And when I say portfolio construction, I'm alluding more to portfolio sizing. So what typically happens is that, a typical investor either ends up with too many stocks with little investment, or they end up with highly concentrated bets. To be able to find, I'm assuming the middle ground is the right ground, it requires a lot of deliberate effort, right? How do you decide what percentage to allocate? So I want you to talk to us a little bit about how you think of position sizing and the importance it plays in portfolio construction. And how should our viewers and listeners think about that?
Okay, before position sizing, I would like to say, first of all, look at how your entire net worth is allocated, the asset allocation.
Okay.
So because as I say that, you know, in Google Maps or whatever, you don't just have to know the destination, you have to know the starting point. And you'll be surprised at how many people don't know what their current investment pie looks like. And I'm talking not just about retail investors. Large family offices also are sometimes think that they are mostly in fixed income and then find they are mostly in real estate. So look at how much real estate, how much fixed income, how much equity, how much gold, how is it? And then look at where you want to be. Because And this is there on page one of any investment book, but which you learn only through experience, is that 85 to 90% of your returns come from asset allocation. Which asset, which geographies, which sectors. So that is why we say that, you know, don't get caught in scars, which was that Asian crisis learning, that single country, single currency, single asset risk. So if you're only in Indian equities, that is not a completely safe place to be in. Now, coming to what you should be doing in equities, again, look at sectors, because often I find that people just keep adding stocks. Yahan se suna, wahan se suna, you know, TV pe suna, some friend says. And then if you look at it at the end of it, it's a very skewed portfolio towards two or three sectors. And this holds not again for retail investors. It holds for a lot of funds and PMS schemes also. People say that it's a good thing to invest in your quote-unquote circle of competence. I say it's a euphemism for comfort zone. And why should you be a prisoner to your fund manager's comfort zone? That if your fund manager can only understand consumer brands and finance, why should you be there? Because the fact is that no theme runs forever. If you look at the data again for any sector, there is a phase when it does well, a phase when it doesn't do well. Even so-called steady businesses, let us say like a Nestle or Hindustan Lever. Hindustan Lever from the late 90s to 2010 did nothing for 12 long years. Bata had 15 years with no returns. And then whenever anything is not doing well, you quietly drop it from your list. Like ITC last year was not on the FMCG list. And ITC was the first FMCG stock we bought. Got back into this year. So if you are looking at a portfolio of equity, follow a system and see that it's reasonably diversified. I would say at least 25-30 stocks you should have. Because again, people tell me, and you know, sometimes I get these emails or on Twitter that, madam, tell me the next HDFC Bank or Amazon that I can buy for my daughter for the next 25 years. I said, nobody knows at the beginning which one is going to be the multi-bagger. If you did, the portfolio would consist of only multi-baggers. But if you follow a systematic approach, if you buy this 25-30 stocks, you hope that three or five of them might be multi-baggers. But also, this is also equally important. Whenever you take a portfolio decision, tell yourself upfront that I may be wrong. Because the best fund manager in the world is not right 100% of the time or 90% of the time or even 80% of the time. So that is why always tell yourself, because otherwise your mind will rebel when the stock doesn't do as it should. And therefore, you will hesitate to pull the plug. In fact, that is why we say we follow a human plus machine model on the investing side. But on the risk management side, it is more or less machine only. We don't allow human beings to overrule, because human beings will overrule. Because you will think that, yes, I was right. Let's watch it a little more. It will come back. It will do this. It will do that. So be rigid on the risk management front. What diversification does, and this is, you know, mathematically provable, because see, investing is a game of luck and skill. In fact, other than chess, there is no game of skill alone. You know, everything is a combination of luck and skill. And in equity, you know that there are, if after living through COVID, you don't know that there's uncertainty in life. I don't know when you will, you know, in 2020 beginning, who would have said that hotel and airline business will go to zero? So life is unpredictable. There are known unknowns and there are unknown unknowns. So it is only a game of probability. Nobody has a crystal ball which is going to be 100% correct 100% of the time. But what diversification does is that, let's say you have the skill to be right 65% of the time or 70% of the time. Then by having a diversified portfolio, you ensure you get that hit rate of 65 or 70%. It is like tossing a coin. Yeah. You toss a coin 10 times, you might get 8 heads or 9 tails or 8 tails or 9 tails. But if you toss it 100 times, it is closer, it's going to be closer to that 50 mark. Okay.
Yeah.
So by increasing the number of bets, you ensure that your result is close to the expected result. So since, for example, when we've started the PMS, and we always say this, that 60% of what you pay is for risk management, I mean, we've obviously, in the about 2.5 years since we started, we are by far the number one in terms of returns. But more importantly, in risk-adjusted returns, we are roughly double the next one.
Wow.
That is our focus, that volatility must be low, drawdowns must be low. And that always, because investing is a loser's game. You know, for your viewers, go and Google this article by Charles Ellis called The Loser's Game. It's an eye-opening article about how everything in life is either a winner's game and a loser's game. And once you understand that, like in investing, you have to first avoid the big drawdown. So we always err on that side. So if the things are uncertain, we would rather buy insurance and pay a cost. Obviously, insurance costs. It is not cost free, rather than risk a big drawdown.
Yeah, it's like that famous Buffett saying, rule number one, never lose money. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. Right? Something like that. I think there is a Buffett saying. So that's this is interesting what you shared with us. So 25, 30 stocks, it gives you diversification, increases your chances of finding the multi-bagger, which I think it's a great approach. You mentioned about risk and you said, humans will override it, right? Because you want to prove yourself right. You know more than, but let the data take control over there. But in that context, I want to ask you, what's your rule for selling? I think one of the biggest mistakes investors end up making is let their biases, they double down on a bad stock. They double down on a value trap stock. Or they exit too early. Like, selling Infosys, you could have sold it any year and you probably would have been wrong after 5 years or something like that. So what is the process you follow when you try?
I did a video on a blog on this to make a simple, as I said that, 90% of what you see is what to buy and when to buy. So it is like Abhimanyu, you know how to go into the Chakravyuh, you don't know how to come out.
Yeah.
So if you want a very simple rule, first of all, decide on a stop loss and have it as a trailing stop loss. So if you're buying something at 50 rupees, what you must not do is say that I will sell if this goes to 100 or if it goes to 200, because then you will not get the multi-baggers. But do decide on a stop loss. Let's say you decide on a 25% trailing stop loss. Now for the viewers, trailing stop loss means not stop loss from your purchase price. It means from the high the stock reaches. So from 50, it goes to 100, 150, 200, and you have a 25% stop loss. If it comes back to 150, then you get out. Otherwise, you continue to hold it. The only exception to that becomes if one stock becomes a very large percentage of your portfolio, it becomes 40, 50, 70% of your portfolio, then you might want to trim it a bit. I mean, you might still regret it. I mean, obviously, it was not 40, 50%. Like, for example, we trimmed Tata Elxsi along the way several times.
That must hurt a bit. But as long as you're following a process, right? Because sometimes it will not work to your advantage and sometimes it will, right?
Yes. So in fact, like insurance also, that's what we tell our clients at times that, there are phases when that insurance has cost you money, and if the market has not moved up much, then, you don't have much returns for that 3 month period or something. He said, like, you don't say that health insurance is a waste if you were not hospitalized that year.
Okay. I'm going back to asset allocation. And tell us how you do your asset allocation. How have you planned your asset allocation?
See, it depends on, of course, I mean, that trite thing that depends on what stage of life you are in and what goals you have. But even when, and this is an answer I gave recently to somebody who asked me this on social media, that if I'm young and in a good job, should I have 100% in equity? And I said, there are two things. One is that even if you are in a good job, maybe you'll lose your job. Maybe you'll have some other emergency. Maybe you'll want to buy a house. So I would not say that have 100% in equity, number one, do allocate to other asset classes also. That's number one. Obviously, when you're young, you have more to equity. Number two, also don't put it all in India. I'll give you an example. When I started working in the mid-80s, a dollar was 12 rupees. Now it is 80 rupees. So 85% loss in currency terms over a career. So So mm-hmm. do look at global assets also. And global means global. I mean, again, people think in Nasdaq ETF khareed liya to ho gaya globalized. That is not how it works. Again, global, you have to do a lot of recalibration along the way in terms of asset classes, in terms of geographies. And there you have, of course, many more asset classes. You have real estate investment trust, commodities.
How does an ordinary regular investor navigate this space? You just go
We do have global products which start at $10,000, so they're just about 8 lakh rupees. So I mean, because that was our aim also, because otherwise a truly global product is not accessible unless you have about $1 million at the minimum. So we wanted to have something, because that was, you know, people used to ask us also that as a small investor, what do I do? So this was the lowest entry point we could come up with. And so we have that product for... Yeah.
And for you, Devina, you are investing in Indian stocks, global stocks, you're doing all that. You're doing real estate for yourself?
No, real estate is not... See, actually, I have been... maybe being in the market, I have been disinclined towards illiquid investments. So whether it is real estate or whether it is non-public markets, even for equities, I have generally steered clear. So, and real estate is a jhanjati thing also. You have to manage it. I have no bandwidth to do that sort of thing. So
I wish I knew that. But anyways.
Why do you say that? Achha, you bought real estate.
Yeah. What about gold? Do you believe in gold?
Only a little bit. I have not personally bought a lot of gold, but I mean, generally, yes, you can have some. It's a reasonable allocation to have. But also remember, like, again, people have these grand ideas that gold is good. But from the early 80s, for 20 years, gold gave no returns. That's also the data. So
there's risk everywhere. It's not an easy choice. So I can see paintings in the background. So do you invest in paintings or just out of pleasure?
I have not no serious investment in paintings. So my paintings have mostly been from the Kalagola Art Festival and the like.
You won't believe this. I was just talking about that a couple of hours ago. Because the season's coming in Bombay, right? Where the lights and the festivals start. Kalagola happens February. Right. But yeah, let's see how it goes this year. So one question related to all this portfolio, money allocation. Do you keep cash aside for living expenses just so that you have the flexibility to not touch your portfolio in case of...
You will have something in liquid assets that everybody should have at least.
Okay. We won't spend much time on that. Now let's talk about the system of yours. From what one of my colleagues told me is that I must talk to you about this is this thing about man plus machine is better than only machine.
It's human plus machine, not man.
Human plus machine. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about that. Human plus machine is better than machine. Talk to us a little bit about, and you mentioned this earlier in the podcast, that even the way you do things has changed from the 90s till now.
Sure.
Tell us what you're doing.
The way I was doing it in the 90s was fun for me personally. Yeah. But the analogy I give is that when the playing field changes, you have to change. So if I look at, if you look at hockey, for example, India, and for that matter, the subcontinent dominated hockey from the 1930s to the 70s. And then AstroTurf came in and the skill set changed. That instead of the dribbling and stick work of Major Dhyan Chand, now you needed to be very fast, very fit, very agile, and you didn't have those skill sets. So now you're seeing it in autos, for example. You cannot say I'll make only combustion engine and not look at electric vehicles if you're an automaker. So same thing happening in investing. People are still stuck in the 90s, but now things have moved on, because what has happened is earlier the advantage used to be that you could get differential information if you met a company but now all around the world, that information advantage has been arbitraged away. Earlier, not just in India, Fidelity could sit with an IBM or a Procter & Gamble and get some information. But now everybody has the same information. Now what you need to do is to really be good at analyzing that information. So that it requires a different skill set. And I will also tell you a very interesting thing. Globally, we've been managing money since 2015, but in India, we had a PMS license from year 2000. When did we actually launch a product? In 2020, after 20 years. Simply because you can manage your money anyhow, that you know that you buy 10 stocks, 2 give you great returns, you know, 5 might be a write-off also, you don't care. But I didn't want to take somebody else's money and do something where there was little predictability. So said that till there is predictability, some consistency, I'm not going to do it. I mean, that risk-adjusted return I was talking about has come out of a system. So only when we had that system did we launch a product. So because, you know, you don't need to do it for the money. And I am quite upset about the amount of mis-selling in the financial services business, where people do not respect that it is someone's hard-earned money and just mislead them for their own gains. And even in fund or schemes, if you see, you have all these thematic funds coming, for example, small cap or particular industry. And most of these come at the peak of a cycle because it's an easy way to gather AUM. But is it a good thing for the investor? Almost invariably not.
Yeah.
So coming back to this, so this is a very, very rigorous system. What we have, it is not a casual system. You know, like people say that do quant methods work? And I said that's like saying that are estimates made on Excel sheets, right? It is just a tool. Yeah. It depends on what you are doing with it. And what we actually have over 1 million lines of code. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. That's an actual fact. An extremely rigorous way that, so this has been a new learning for me. I mean, not that I am a tech geek, but at least you have to have a working knowledge. And my team is extremely strict about, you know, not allowing any kind of anything which is a deviation from the way it should be done. They said, like, once you make one deviation, then you can't trust the results. So yeah. In sample, out of sample, what to do, survivorship free data, which it's a data itself, data cleaning is itself a big thing. But with the results now, like globally, we look at 20,000 plus securities. We choose from that, which is obviously not humanly possible, no matter how big a team you have. And then, of course, it is consistent. It is bias free. So, and you can look at hundreds of factors per company. So, for example, growth, we don't just look at growth. Growth, you can say, is like, you know, first derivative. You can look at the second derivative, which is acceleration, third derivative, which is jerk. And earlier, I thought, you know, that maybe a machine can analyze things, but what if the data is, if it is fudged?
Yep.
But what we found is that because it looks at so many factors together, it catches every single instance of manipulation. You know, whether it is Manpasand, the averages, or Under Armour, it gets it. It might get it well before it might be a year before the scandal breaks, but we are not looking too short. So as an avoid, it tells you that there's a red flag here, avoid. So it's been very interesting.
I love this conversation because, you know, whenever you talk stocks, you've got an Indian name and an international name. And because usually we are just so focused on India, and that's so nice. So thank you for that perspective. So how's that? The system's been in operation for 2 years. How's
the
it going
system has been in operation for longer? I mean, we've sort of, now it's like February 2020 onwards, it's been an actual with outside money as well.
Has done well. You're happy with the outcome, of course. So
I mean, it's up 104% as against, I think, NSE 500 is up some 65%. And the strange part is that there's, I think, only one other PMS scheme or two which have done even better than the NSE 500. None of the others have even beaten the market.
Congrats, congrats on that. Let's move forward. We're coming to the last section, but the most important section. You have a global perspective, so this really matters a lot. What do you think is happening in India in terms of the economy? And what is like your 10-year view on what could happen? And if I may add a third element to it, why do you think, if at all you think, is it different this time? India has had a kind of a false start in 91, right? There was a few years and then we stalled. There are a few years of progress and we stalled. But now there's this whole belief that this time it's different. So if you can talk a little bit about all of that.
I don't think we had a false start in 1991. That's when you've seen the whole ecosystem change completely. And I always say that my generation was a big beneficiary of that, because from the very early years of your career, in the next 15 years, for example, the entire compensation structure changed. You know, that when I joined Citibank, my salary, I think, was some, including all the perks and everything, was some 27,000 a year. Can you imagine? And this was the most coveted job from MBA campuses. So that changed completely. The whole IT, ITS thing, of course, changed, not just for people directly employed, but a whole lot of others. So I mean, right now, there are things which worry me. For one, unemployment is at a decades high, at I think 3 or 4 decades high. Even before the COVID problem, we were at, I think, a 40-year high on unemployment. So my worry is that you have this demographic dividend, so-called. But see, if you look at the way the demographic dividend actually pays off, so it is number of people in the working age multiplied by how many of them are actually working multiplied by the productivity. So right now you have a big gap, and that, you know, this demographic dividend is available to you for a limited period of time. And if you don't manage to use it, and youth unemployment in particular is extremely high. So what you're seeing is a good thing for listed companies, because generally there is more formalization of the economy and more things moving to the organized sector, which is also showing up in better tax collections and all that. But still, there are a lot of things to be done, and job creation is one big one. If you look at per capita income also, we are not yet back to 2019 levels. This year, it would require a 3% growth to just go back to that number. So, like, a lot of things to be done. I hope we manage to do it. And because we do have this large young population, and if we manage to utilize it well, there are things you can do both on the manufacturing front as well as on the services front. The services remain a relatively low-hanging fruit, and not just IT services, but other kinds of services also, where you can look at exports. So those are things which I hope we manage to get done, because you would like the country to really progress. You know, and China started in 1978, so they had a 12-13 year advantage over us, but now that gap has widened far more.
And we can actually see this the problem we'll face in the future already, where China's demographic dividend is petering out, and now they're having to reverse all their policies of know, birth control and all that. So so that's probably.
We have to take advantage of this. I mean, that should be the number one priority.
China did it by becoming the factory of the world. And what's your gut feel? So we have a services sector which is growing, which is the IT sector, which everyone talks about.
Yeah, but other than IT, also manufacturing, there are other areas where where if you can negotiate better with your partners, you know, right from medicine to legal to a lot of things can come here. And of course, but I mean, for mass employment, you will still need manufacturing. And manufacturing, we still have a big gap. And not just now, I mean, for 20, 30 years, most large companies take pride in not employing people. I mean, even any steel plant or auto plant or whatever, as I said, not just now, but even 20, 25 years ago, companies would with pride say that we have almost no labor in this plant.
Automation. Automation is key. That's what got P multiples and all that. So I'm so amongst all the podcasts we've had this year, yours is a little different view. You're a little more circumspect. You're thinking about what are the problems and whether they'll get solved. Typically,
actually, I mean, see, this is also a issue of most fund managers, again, are always in asset gathering mode. So you always have to sell the India growth story in order for people to excite people to invest. But that's not the way I like to look at things. I like to say things the way I see them rather than it be a selling or marketing exercise too.
And I would expect that I suspect that the way you pitch First Global is more of a bottom up stock picker. So you're taking
always
macro calls as well.
No, I mean you have to look at the macros as well. I mean, of course, we actually have a combination of systems. So one is looking at this bottom up in terms of financials, but for example, we do look at and a lot of things which we think in sitting in India that this is what is happening in this sector are actually global trends. So for example, last year, February, some of these systems showed us that marine and transportation sector looks very good. And we bought it in several countries and that was a big winner even before it actually started to show up in the transport rates and all that. So you have to keep a sense of that. And we always say that the world is like a giant wheel. And there are geographies and assets which are going up and some which are going down, because there's always a simultaneous bull and bear market. You know, when Asia crisis time, when all these markets fell 50 to 90%, Europe was up 20% in that year. And always, see, and whatever is happening, you will find a story to justify it. So in 2003 to 2007, for example, emerging markets did very, very well. They were up 3.5 times. India was up 6 times. Brazil was up 10 times. Then the thing was, US is yesterday's story. Now the next century belongs to the emerging markets.
And so then the next 10 years,
find a story to fit the facts. So.
Well, you're a learner. So why don't you tell us or give us some recommendations of stuff we should read? You mentioned The Loser's Game.
That's an article. Of course, that's a book also, but I am talking about the article.
Tell us more. What should what should we all be reading to become a little more?
I mean, if you don't have a formal education in finance, I would say start with the textbooks, because you must know the basics, and then also some basic books on valuation, like Damodaran's book or the Scopeland book that I mentioned. One area that I find really, really interesting is to understand how your mind works. So what are the biases, or what are the things which, like, for example, Thinking Fast and Slow, I recommend quite often, The Halo Effect, Richard Thaler's books on behavioral finance. Now from Daniel Kahneman, there's also Noise. And two recent books that I, again, put different ways of looking at things. One is Gillian Tett's book, what's it called? Anthrovision, I think it's on how to use anthropological thinking. And then there is this other book called Everything is Obvious Once You Know the Answer, which is what we were talking
That's
about.
So that obvious. Whatever That's
happens,
so obvious
you can always find a story to fit that. There are books on, because ultimately investing is about businesses, so there are many books about businesses that either autobiographies of entrepreneurs or of businesses. So there are a whole bunch of that. The most exciting one I've read is Richard Branson's. What a roller coaster of a life.
I've read that book. It's an interesting book. Yeah. He started by transporting what, CDs illegally across the border or something, right? That's the book, right?
And so many times he came to the brink of losing the business virtually. So they're like, and you, as you read those books, you will also understand that the story is never as simple or linear as it looks from the outside. Amazon, you think that this is the story. But once you read about Amazon, you find that they tried dozens of things at different stages, and most of them did work out. Something worked out. Apple, for example, I just tweeted this yesterday, that people think that Steve Jobs came back after 12 years and Apple, boom. But actually 7 years after he came back, 7 whole years, Apple went nowhere. It was just some years little profit, some year little loss business. So after 7 years, they got a hit product and then it took off. Yeah. But that's not how we remember it.
We go by the headlines. So the headlines say something else, right? You need to go deep. In anything internationally that you think we should read, I think you've got global exposure and it comes through in your thinking and the way you do stuff and, you know, all the success you've had. And I think I personally try and read a lot of international stuff. Like I do read the Wall Street Journal. Now it's digital, so it's easy to read. What do you recommend that people read internationally to get a broader perspective?
Most of the books I have mentioned are international books. But in terms of news, of course, there is like now a whole lot of things you can read. Yeah. But also be cognizant of biases of different publications. So, you know, don't swallow everything whole.
Yeah.
So, I mean, better to first understand the basic news rather than someone's opinion of that news.
Yeah. And to understand bias, I think everyone should read Cialdini's Influence, right? Kind of a bias
is, of course, thinking fast and slow is the best.
Yeah, that's the best book.
That's in any case, like right up there in my best ever books.
So, Divina, it's been a wonderful, wonderful session. Thank you very much for taking the time. Very thought-provoking. And I'm sure our viewers and listeners are going to love it. So, thank you very much.
Great being here. A very different interview.
That's what it is about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again and see you at the next edition of the Investor Hour.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.